Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about a woman who did the hard version of a hard thing. Everybody knows about flying the Atlantic, but almost nobody stops to ask which direction and direction, friends, is the whole story tonight. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger and this is the hangar, where we sit with the old stories and the old airplanes and let them breathe a little. Today we're going west, the wrong way, on purpose. Before I get into it, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And if there was ever a flight that deserved a coin, it's this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, let me set the scene. It's the early 1930s, and the Atlantic Ocean has become the proving ground for every pilot with more nerve than sense. Charles Lindbergh went west to east, New York to Paris, in 1927. And here's the thing most folks never think about. He had the wind at his back. The prevailing winds over the North Atlantic blow from west to east. When you fly from America toward Europe, the sky is pushing you along like a hand on your shoulder. Now flip it around. Fly from Europe to America. And that same wind is a wall. It's in your teeth the entire way. Slower ground speed. More hours in the air. More fuel burned to cover the same water. It is mile for mile, the meaner direction. And by 1936, no one had ever flown it solo and nonstop from England to North America. Not one soul. Men had died trying. Enter Beryl Markham. Now here's where it gets interesting. Beryl Markham was not, by any stretch, what the newspapers of the day expected a record-breaking aviator to look like. She was born in England in 1902, but she was raised in British East Africa, Kenya. She grew up barefoot on a farm, learning to hunt with the local Nandi children, running with them, learning their language. She was in every sense that mattered a child of Africa.
And before she ever touched an airplane, she made her name doing something else entirely. She trained racehorses, became one of the first licensed female horse trainers in Kenya, and a good one. She had a feel for living things that move fast and don't want to be told what to do. Turns out that's not a bad instinct for a pilot. She came to flying in her late 20s, learned it in the African bush, and became a working pilot. And I don't mean she flew for fun on Sunday afternoons. She flew the mail. She flew passengers. She scouted elephant herds from the air for the big game safari outfits, spotting the animals and radioing their position to the hunters on the ground. She flew a little open cockpit airplane over some of the most unforgiving terrain on the planet, alone, with no radio navigation to speak of, no weather service worth the name, and engines that in those days quit when they felt like it. She flew over jungle, over desert, over mountains where a forced landing meant you simply did not come home. She logged her hours in a country that killed careless pilots for sport. By the time she decided to take on the Atlantic, she was not some society girl chasing headlines. She was a hardened, cold-eyed professional who had spent years learning the one lesson the bush teaches better than any flight school ever could. The airplane does not care how you feel. Fly it or die. Simple as that. So the idea comes to her. Fly the Atlantic, east to west, England to New York, solo, non-stop. The way no one had done it, the airplane was a Percival Vega Gull. A pretty little thing. A low-wing British monoplane, wooden single-engine four seats normally. But for this trip, the cabin was stripped out and filled with fuel tanks instead. She named her the Messenger. Painted a deep blue with silver trim, powered by a single de Havilland Gypsy 6 engine up front, about 200 horsepower. That's it. 200 horses to drag her and all that gasoline across 2,000 miles of open ocean into the wind the whole way.
Think about what was riding on that one engine. There is no second engine. There's no ditching and being picked up by a passing ship. Not really. Not in the North Atlantic in September. If that Gypsy 6 so much as hiccuped over the middle of that ocean, the story was over. She knew it. She'd already buried enough friends to know exactly what she was agreeing to. The flight was backed by a man named John Carberry, a wealthy and frankly unpleasant character from her Kenya circle. And there's a story, whether it's exactly true or dressed up over the years, I'll let you decide, that as she was preparing to leave, Carberry said something to her.
Cold as you please, something to the effect of, I wonder which ocean you'll drown in. That was the send-off. That was the vote of confidence she carried to the airplane.
September 4th, September 1936. Abingdon, England, an airfield west of London. The weather was rotten. Rain, low cloud, and a wind that had been blowing hard out of the west for days. The exact wind she'd have to fight. Everybody told her to wait. Wait for a better day. And she looked at the calendar,
and she looked at the shortening autumn days, and she made the call every pilot in the world understands in their bones. The weather was never going to be good. It was only going to get worse as the season turned. She was going now. The messenger was so heavy with fuel that getting her off the ground was its own act of faith. That little airplane lumbered down the wet grass, tail up, wheels clinging to the earth, that gypsy engine screaming at full throttle, and she hauled it into the air by sheer stubbornness with the runway running out beneath her, and then she was over the water alone, heading into the dark and into the wind. Now I want you to sit inside that cockpit with me for a minute. Because we throw around the word solo like it's nothing, we forget what it actually meant.
There is no autopilot. She is hand-flying that airplane every single second. 20-some hours, and her hands never leave the controls in any way that matters. There's no ground controller talking to her, no radar following her progress, no moving map. She has a compass, an airspeed indicator, an altimeter, a clock, and a chart. That's the whole toolkit. She is navigating by dead reckoning, heading speed and time. Do the math, hold the heading, trust the numbers, and pray the wind is doing what you guessed it would do, over the open ocean. At night, in cloud, there is nothing to look at. No horizon, no lights, no stars. When the overcast closes in, just the dim glow of the instruments and the black. Pilots call it the graveyard. That disorientation. When your inner ear starts lying to you and you can't tell up from down, she flew through hours of that. And the cold, that wooden cabin was not heated in any way you or I would recognize. The North Atlantic in September, at altitude, at night, is a bitter, bone-deep cold that gets into the airplane and into you and does not let go. Picture her wrapped in flying gear, cramped in among the fuel tanks. The whole airframe humming and shuddering around her, the smell of gasoline and oil and cold rubber, the engine roaring so loud and so long, that after a while your ears simply stop hearing it as sound and start feeling it as a pressure inside your skull, hour after hour. The wind in her teeth the entire way, shoving her back, stealing her ground speed, drinking her fuel faster than the arithmetic said it should. And here's the part that turns the whole flight on its head. The messenger carried her fuel in several tanks, and there was a system to it. You'd run one tank until it ran low, then reach down and switch a valve, a petcock, to draw from a fresh tank. Standard practice, she'd done it 100 times as the long night wore on and she got out over the far side of the ocean. Closer to Canada than to England, one of her tanks ran dry, right on schedule. She reached down to switch to the next one, and the engine died. Just like that, out over the water. One of the fuel tank vents had iced over. Frozen shut in that brutal cold. And with the vent iced up, the fuel couldn't feed. The tank she was trying to draw from wouldn't deliver. That mighty roar that had been in her skull for 20 hours went silent. And in its place came the one sound no pilot ever wants to hear over open ocean. The wind, just the wind, whistling past a dead airplane and a stopped propeller. She was gliding now, descending toward the water. And she did exactly what you would hope a bush pilot, with 10,000 hours of trouble behind her, would do. She did not panic. She worked the problem. She nursed it, worked the tanks, coaxed that frozen system, and the engine caught again, roared back to life. She climbed away. And then it happened again. And again, as the flight wore on toward its end, that iced vent kept starving the engine, and the engine kept quitting, and each time she had to fight it back to life over the cold gray water. Imagine your heart, every one of those times. The silence, the glide, the desperate work with numb fingers, and the miracle every single time of that Gypsy Six barking back to life just when it counted. She crossed the coast of North America, but she was not going to make New York. Not now. The engine was starving, the airplane was dying by inches, and she was running out of both fuel and altitude over the fog-shrouded coast of Nova Scotia. She'd made it across the ocean that was supposed to drown her. She'd beaten it, and now she just needed to get the wheels down alive. She came down through the murk over Cape Breton Island at a place called Belen Cove, and what looked from the air like solid, welcoming ground turned out to be a peat bog, soft, wet, and grabbing. The wheels touched, dug in, and the little blue airplane flipped up onto her nose and stopped, buried in the muck, tail in the air, prop and engine driven into the earth. But Beryl Markham crawled out of that cockpit, bleeding from a cut on her head, mud to her knees, cold to the marrow, alive. She had done it. 21 hours and change in the air. The first person ever to fly solo and nonstop from England to North America, the hard way, into the wind. And she'd done it in a wooden airplane with one engine, no radio help, and a fuel system that tried to kill her a half dozen times over the coldest water on Earth. Now here's the part I love, and it's why her name should be as big as any of them. Local fishermen came running across the bog to pull her out.
She'd been aiming for a triumphant landing in New York with cameras and crowds, and instead she was standing knee-deep in a Canadian peat bog being hauled out by men who'd never heard her name. And when the news got out, the world caught up in a hurry. She'd made history, and the fact that she came down in a bog instead of a boulevard didn't change 1 mile of that ocean she'd crossed. But Beryl Markham did one more thing that most of these record chasers never managed. Years later, she sat down and she wrote it all out, a memoir called West with the Night. And it is, I'll just say it, one of the most beautiful books ever written about flying, by anybody, ever. Ernest Hemingway, a man not known for handing out compliments, read it and wrote to a friend that she had written so well that he felt like a carpenter with words next to her. He said it was a bloody wonderful book. Coming from Hemingway, that's about the highest praise a writer ever got. And what makes the book sing isn't the record, it's the flying, the Africa of it, the nights over the bush, the feel of an airplane in your hands, the loneliness and the joy of it. Written by someone who had actually lived every word. She wasn't describing flight from the outside, she was writing it from inside the cockpit, from inside a life spent alone in the air over wild country.
So the next time somebody tells you about crossing the Atlantic, ask them which way. Because going east, the wind carries you, going west, you carry yourself. Beryl Markham went west, into the teeth of it, alone, with one engine that kept dying and a whole ocean waiting underneath, and she flew it anyway. Fly it or die, she flew it. My thanks tonight to Beryl Markham herself, whose own memoir West with the Night tells this story better than I ever could. And it's still in print if you want to hear it in her own voice. You'll find us anytime at radiohanger.com. And I'll tell you what, friends, next time you're bucking a headwind on the way home, ground speed in the tank, watching your fuel and grumbling about it, think of a blue wooden airplane over the North Atlantic in the dark, and maybe smile a little. This is Tail Dragger. Fly the wind you've got.